Sairam, and welcome to all our dear listeners to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang, where both of us, Prem and myself, will continue conversations with Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba as penned down by Dr. Hislop. But before we go into that, as always, we shall offer our humble pranams at the lotus feet of beloved Bhagwan and wish all our listeners a very happy, holy and hearty New Year 2020. It has been an amazing time at Prashanthi Nilayam. The year-end of late has become concretized as that time when the alumni from across the globe, across institutions, across the educational institutions of Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba, come and offer their gratitude, their love and their respect. They express all these as in the form of cultural programs, speeches, music, drama. And from the 31st of December, 30th of December to be precise, because we had the music college alumni coming on the 30th evening. For the 30th evening, the alumni from the primary school and the higher secondary school for the 31st evening, and the alumni of the university on the first evening. It has been a wonderful, wonderful 3 days, a wonderful goodbye to 2019 and a very lovely welcome to 2020. For those of you who missed these programs live, do visit our YouTube channel and see them. It was really fantastic, you know, starting from the music program on the 30th to the beautiful drama on what it means to have true devotion to God, a drama of Krishna Dasa on the 31st. Then on the 1st, of course, another drama based on the life of Krishna. You know, I just have a feeling that the closest avatar that comes to our beloved Swami is possibly Krishna in terms of the mischief, in terms of the poignancy, in terms of everything. An all-rounded, wholesome avatar. I think only Krishna compares to Swami, and it is no surprise that the students pick Krishna as the main character or as the divine character in the drama to be depicted. So it has been really, really wonderful. So soul-filling and fulfilling. In fact, it might also feel like an overdose in 3 days because it was so power-packed. It can be slowly assimilated and digested across many days. So before beginning our actual satsang, I would like to request all of you to definitely go and view these programs which are there on the YouTube channel, the 30th, the 31st and the 1st, and join all of us in welcoming the new year with love in our hearts, with gratitude to Swami for another beautiful year that has gone by and another beautiful year that is about to begin. So with that brief introduction, let's begin today's afternoon satsang and let us invite Brother Prem, Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind and Sairam to all our listeners, and a very, very happy new year to everyone. It is indeed a good fortune to bask year after year in Swami's presence, and one of the best ways to know that your life is being led in a happy way is to know that the time passes without you realizing that it has gone by, and 2019 did go by so fast. And if you look at it, 2010 to 2020 was a very eventful one decade for all of us. It's also the conclusion of a decade which changed a lot of things for us, some things which we were not prepared for. But in many ways, I think Swami has also allowed us to discover Him in different ways. And the mind needed that shock to understand that you never lose Swami. And we're going to talk about some of the examples that Swami is going to give in the conversations today, which all shows that it is an access which is always available. If you want Swami, He's there for you. If you seek Him, He's always there for you. I think every drama that was portrayed as part of this festival, or for that matter, every drama which most of the students and alumni end up making is that if you want Swami, He's there and He can be discovered even now, wherever you are. You don't have to come to Prashanthi Nilayam, you don't have to go to Vrindavan, you don't have to go to a specific place, because the Lord is always with you. And with that encouragement in our mind, we do everything that we can so that we are able to reach out to Swami, and whatever satsang we do, whatever programs that we do, everything is only an expression of that craving and desire.
I also think that, you know, the dramas that we see presented in Kulwanthal, which have such a deep impact on all of us viewers, is because we see that the characters in the drama, the actors in the drama, seem to be genuinely living the drama. For instance, there was a drama in which the role of Sudama had to be played by one of the alumnus brothers who is holding a high corporate position. So involved was he in the role that he actually shaved his entire head so that, you know, because he wasn't satisfied with the costumed shaved head that was given to him. So he shaved his entire head, and in fact, while doing that role, which lasted about 3-4 minutes, he had genuine tears in his eyes. And if we actually go into the history or the practice sessions of these dramas, as we have done so to a certain extent, we discover that Swami has been showing that he is always with them, guiding them, guarding them, giving love, giving strength, giving energy in magical ways. You know, in fact, on some of the alumni WhatsApp groups and other groups, a lot of such wonderful leelas and mahimas of Bhagwan are being discussed. It's such a pleasure when you see that behind that drama that was actually presented in Kulwanthal are many, many, many dramas which are possibly mightier and more poignant than the actual drama that is happening in Kulwanthal. It's very, very heartening. Like, it is, as all the participants unanimously say, more than, I mean, the drama on the final day in Sai Kulwanthal, in Bhagwan's, near Bhagwan's Sannidhi, is an amazing experience, no doubt. But they are already overwhelmed with bliss and love of Swami because of the drama that has happened in preparation for the drama.
And absolutely, and I think every New Year is in that sense, though it is being celebrated by the old students, it only gives all of us the idea that how do you connect back to Swami, how do you turn back to Swami. Their process of reconnection only helps us in this process of trying to touch base with Swami, so to say. So with that, dear listeners, we'll go into the first afternoon satsang of 2020 of this new decade. It's a continuation of the conversations with Sai. It's been a wonderful journey in this book. A lot of things, not everything that we comprehend, not everything that we can completely understand, but a lot of very small details, very beautiful explanations that Swami gives. Many, many standout lessons from there, and I think it has enriched both of us, and we do hope that it's enriching all of your journey with Swami. We will continue with that. We stopped at in the middle of a conversation, really, last time when we were discussing. And of course, last week we took a break to have a program on Christmas, on theme of
the cutting the eye.
Cutting the eye, which Swami said the cross represents. Coming back to what we were talking about, the conversation was revolving around a very beautiful question that Hisla asked about what is it to have a divine vision. A lot of times the rishis and the great sages are described as ones with a divine vision. They are called as mantra drashtaras, those who can see those mantras. They receive those mantras. They are also called tattva darshis, or those who can see the truth. So always there is a reference about the divine vision, and Hislop asks about that, and Swami gives one of the greatest sages and kingly sages from the Puranas as an example, that of Janaka. Swami says how once when he had the vision of that enlightenment, he went back to doing his tasks as a king, but with that understanding, with that enlightenment. And Swami is speaking how everything becomes the same for him. There is no pain and pleasure, but he goes back to doing his work, and that's why Janaka is known as a Karma Yogi, is known as a Rajarishi.
You know, speaking of divine vision, I'm reminded of a little conversation that happened when we were in a tri session at Vrindavan. So Swami was seated on the jhula, and he had told Mr. Ajit Popat to deliver a talk. And for those who are unaware of Mr. Ajit Popat, he's an amazing inspirational personality, great love for Bhagwan. I think he has been a devotee of Swami for decades, 3-4 decades. He's from the United Kingdom. So he was speaking, and it was another inspirational talk. At the end of the talk, Swami asked him, "What do you want?" So it was very interesting what he replied. He said, Swami, when Arjuna saw Krishna in that cosmic form, what was that blessing that Krishna had given him? I want eyes like that. Then Swami told him, no, Arjuna didn't see it with those eyes. With the physical eyes you can't see. You need Divya Chakshu, you need divine eyes. Then Ajit Popat said, Swami, give me those eyes, that is what I want. Swami said, yes, I will give. Swami had said like that, and that's where the conversation ended. So it became very clear that when we say divine vision, it is not anything to do with the physical eyes or this physical capacity of sight. It is more about, if for lack of better English word, I can say perspective or attitude, that which changes, that helps us to see the divine. Because when there is a being who has divine sight, it is not as if the eyes undergo any transformation or anything. The way they view things changes. So I think last time we were discussing this conversations with Sai, we stopped at a point where, as you said, Hislop is asking about divine vision. Swami introduces the concept of a God-realized person, because divine vision and God-realization are quite close to each other. And Hislop asks, what is the difference between a person of divine vision and a person who is God-realized? And Hislop's focus is, I'm asking this question because I want to know more about what it means to have divine vision. However, Swami's answer is, again, we had discussed it at length last time. Swami's answer, differentiating between a person of divine vision and a person who is God-realized, is such that Swami's emphasis is fully on the definition and description of a God-realized person. So apparently Hislop is not satisfied because he is keen to know about divine vision. Because from Swami's description of a God-realized person or a Jivan Mukta, it becomes very evident that the Jivan Mukta is a notch higher than the person with divine vision. So Hislop then asks, sorry Swami, divine vision is still not clearly understood. And Swami replies, there is a piece of clear glass. From one side one can look through and see the object on the other side. If the clear glass is plated with silver film on one side, it becomes a mirror in which one may see himself, and objects on the other side of the mirror are not seen. Likewise, through consciousness, one may see the outside sensory world. Or with his intelligence, he may look to and become aware of that which may be found within himself. If one lives and keeps himself within the reality found within, with godly thoughts, desires and interests, if one keeps his life centered on the godly side of consciousness, the consciousness becomes a mirror coated on its outer surface with the dust of the sensory world. On the pure inward surface of this mirror, on the pure mind and the pure heart, one may see the reality of himself reflected, and this constitutes self-realization. That is Raja Yoga. King Janaka became one who lived his life this way. So, it's a beautiful analogy where Swami says that, like a glass, if there's a piece of glass, you can look from this side to the other side or from the other side to this side. So also Swami says, it's like a glass. You can see outside through it or you can see inside through it. Swami says, if you choose to see inside through it, over time, inside refers to obviously the self and outside obviously refers to the world. Swami says, if we continue to see the inside, then everything that is worldly, all the worldly thoughts, all the worldly desires and all the worldly interests, all of them, Swami refers to them with the term worldly dust. Swami says, the world itself becomes a worldly dust which coats the glass in such a manner that you begin to see only yourself. Just imagine a glass in front of you. From this side I am able to see the world, from the other side I am able to see inside myself. If I choose to always see within, over time, everything of the world becomes a dust which forms a coating on this glass, so that the glass is no longer a glass, it becomes a mirror, so that anywhere I see, I always see myself only. And so Swami says that is the way. It's almost like Swami saying, see, start focusing on what is within, then a time will come when whatever is outside also will be nothing but a reflection of what is within.
Right, the distinction between what Swami answered previously and this one. I think the first time when Khislop asked the same question, Swami says it is to look beyond the names and forms. That is the divine vision. Mm. So I'm using the many forms in front of you, but to be able to see beyond that, and we had discussed how tattva is to see beyond the name and form and to see the thatness which is essential behind everything. In this one, it's again another very beautiful concept which Swami often speaks about. The self-realized person or the person who is a sadhaka, who turns within, and a person who is getting to attach to the world uses the same consciousness. It is not like you need it. You know, it's all about what we refer to as what are you going to use your time and energy for.
Hmm.
If you're going to use your time and energy for pursuing the world, then you become a worldly person. If you use the same time and energy for turning within, you become a spiritual person, you become a spiritual aspirant. So Swami is saying it's the same consciousness with which you see, and it's a very, very beautiful and crisp analogy that Swami is giving. The mirror that we look at to look at ourselves is also a glass, right? It's essentially the same thing. And you use the same vision to look through a glass or look at a mirror to look at yourself. So Swami is saying that you don't have to do anything out of the ordinary in that sense. Divine vision is not something which is acquired from outside. I think that is the sense which Swami is giving. You know, when you're talking about Mr. Ajit Popat asking that, you know what you want, but you look at an example like Arjuna and said that he had a divine vision, so he had that vision, so I want the divine vision. Actually, what you want is the vision. It's not what equipped him to have that vision.
Mm.
It's almost like other day, I mean, as part of all the alumni recollections, one of the primary school alumni was saying that Swami had called them for a class interview. I think these were all 11th or 12th standard girls. Swami had called them for an interview. So Swami looked at one of the students and asked, what do you want? And she said, Swami, I want only you. And Swami was very pleased. Swami waved his hand and materialized a chain for her and put it around her. And immediately the other child looked at Swami and said, Swami, even I want only you. You know, suggesting, you know what you want, but you think that this is going to get that. So when we talk about divine vision, we are thinking like that needs, you know, something else that you have to acquire. You have to go and do something. But Swami is very clearly saying that it's the same consciousness. We added that discourse to the Satya Tusa episode, the previous one, where Swami is saying whether you're getting attached to the world or you're getting attached to God, that energy which becomes attachment is the same. It is not like it's something different. Swami said the same Shakti becomes Rakti towards the world, or it becomes Bhakti towards God.
It becomes Virakti and then Rakti towards God. Yes.
Right. So Swami, in that sense, it's the same eyes that you're going to use, it's the same consciousness, it's the same energy, it's the same life that Swami has given that you're going to use. But simple thing of turning within, as Swami would say, you're constantly exploring others' personalities, others, you know, good person, bad person. The day you start turning within, you start, as Swami would say, you start looking at the world as a mirror. Automatically you will start looking within, you will say that, okay, these are the experiences I'm having. What in myself has to be changed so that I don't face this experience again? And that's the clear distinction between a worldly life and a spiritual life, when you start turning to yourself.
You know, sometime back in the conversations itself, there was this interesting thing that Hislop brought up, saying the mind's tendency is to do this, the brain, the intellect's tendency is to do this, the senses do this. And Swami says that when they don't do it properly, that's when they go awry. And Hislop points out that, Swami, maybe the Atma is not doing its duty properly, that's why everything is going awry. And that is when beautifully Swami defines what is divinity. Swami says the energy, the passion, the enthusiasm, all these things, that is divinity. Where you choose to channelize it, it will work that way. It was the same divine power that Hiranyakashipu channelized to do evil things. The same divine power that Prahlada channelized to do divine things. So it works, like the popular example of the knife, which in a surgeon's hand becomes a lifesaver, while in a murderer's hand becomes a weapon of murder. So that is what divinity is. And, you know, though Swami gives one side of the story here, I was just thinking probably the other side also holds good. Swami says that, what struck me is, Swami says, if one keeps life centered on the godly side of consciousness, that is the internal vision, the consciousness becomes a mirror coated on its outer surface with the dust of the sensory world. So what struck me in this is, it's almost like if I keep focusing on what is within, the sensory world, which is an attraction actually, which is a distraction actually, that itself becomes the dust coating on the glass, which makes me see only me. I can no longer see the other side of the glass. I don't see a dog, a cat, a tree. Wherever I see only me, because the dust has become the coating. So I was just thinking maybe the corollary also holds true, wherein if I use it to always see outside, maybe then the divinity also becomes like a dust coating on the other side of the mirror, so that what is reflected is only outside. Instead of being able to see divinity in everything, we begin to see the world even in divinity. That is when, that is possibly what we call Maya. We get deluded. We think, how is this happening? Is Swami this? We get doubts. So I think it totally begins with where we choose to focus and where we choose to spend our time and energies. The more time we spend looking within, we will start seeing God even in the world. The more time and energy we spend looking at the world and chasing it, we will start seeing the world even in God. This is how I understood it.
It's a beautiful analogy in that sense, that it covers both of those aspects. Then Hislop goes on to ask, Swami, even perfect men seem to have troubles. And Swami responds to that by saying, various saints, and in fact Swami mentions a few names here, which he's not recorded. Swami says, various saints had endless troubles in their lives with family, harsh treatment from others, and so on. But their faith in God remained untouched. Hislop asks, but Swami, since these men were already purified saints, why did suffering and troubles continue for them? Swami replies, they themselves did not suffer. Jesus did not suffer, but it was necessary they go through what is generally regarded as suffering, so the world could have noble examples of worldly detachment and unshakable faith in God. So Hislop is asking this question, which often comes to us. You know, when you want to take up any path, suppose you're in the cusp of choosing a career for yourself, you'll automatically look at somebody who has already chosen the career and you'll wonder whether that person is faring well. You know, you want to become a doctor, you want to become a chartered accountant, you'll say that, okay, how are these people faring well in life? If I'm finding those people are suffering, why will I take that course, or why will I take, I'll be discouraged from taking that course. And it is quite understandable what Hislop is asking, because we have this tradition of saying that, oh, this saint had suffered from poverty. We have the example of Sudama, who was very poor. We have examples
Thyagaraja.
Of Thyagaraja, who suffered. We have even the sages in our recent memory, like Ramana Maharshi, Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, they suffered from bodily ailments. We know many of them died young. So when you see that, you ask that, you know, should I choose this path? These people seem to have suffered. Jesus, the example that Swami himself is giving.
Swami himself,
right? So the question where it comes from is quite understandable. He's saying that even perfect men seems to be suffering. So is there a way of getting over the suffering? And Swami gives a very beautiful answer, where he says that they suffer in the eyes of the world, and they do that for a certain purpose, so that you look at them. They are going through the same experiences that the people in the world go through, but the way they are going through it is completely different, and that is the inspiration. It is not that they will be spared, or you take to a spiritual path, you will not have your problems, but the problems will not bother you anymore.
And the best way to show it is by example. See, the other day, because this winter gets quite dry, we purchased a small humidifier for the room, and this humidifier gives out water vapor, which looks very, very, very similar to the steam that's coming out of a pressure cooker or a heater, you know. So my little daughter was so scared, mortally scared to go near that. She said, no, it's hot, it's hot. How much ever we tried to tell her that it's not hot, don't worry, she didn't. So finally what we did, both me and my wife, we went and we put our hand into the stream of water vapor that was coming out. With that, suddenly, you know, it was, her fear was gone. So finally the best way to teach or demonstrate is through personal example. That is the reason, that's what Swami is saying, that whoever is the great sages or saints, great men of God, they have gone to a level where worldly suffering and pain does not touch them at all. If they come and tell people that, you know, you go through pain, don't worry, pain will not touch you, you are beyond pain, it will be like me trying to tell my daughter, go touch it, it's not hot. But when they themselves go through that and show that, see, I'm not affected. In fact, when Professor Anil Kumar once asked Swami, Swami, when Swami had broken his hip, he said, Swami, you must be having lot of pain and suffering, right? Swami said, there is pain, but there is no suffering. Because pain is a natural flow of the things in the world, pain and pleasure. But joy and suffering are choices. When you have that, when you have the knowledge of reality, then you are beyond joy and suffering. So Swami said, there is pain, but there is no suffering. So if this message has to be communicated, there is pain, but there is no suffering. If it's only told, we won't understand. That is why Swami says that all these people, men and women of God, and God, when He comes down as an avatar, takes on pain. Every avatar, be it Jesus, be it Rama.
Sanam, dear listeners, we're very sorry about that disruption that happened. We completely lost our power for a few minutes. I think now we are back on air and we should be able to complete the segment. We were discussing about the examples that the saints and sages who undergo suffering place before us. Where Hislop was asking this question of why is it that even perfect people have to undergo suffering, and the answer that Swami gave was that they have to go through the same travails and pains that normal human beings go through, but they go through it with such fortitude, which becomes an example and inspiration for the rest of us. I think that was a point Arvind also was speaking about when we lost our power. So we'll resume that discussion.
You will take it like we took a break, a forced break, and we are back after the break. Yeah. So that discussion, you know, reminds me of the famous quoted example, famous in our circles, I mean, of how the students asked Swami, why is it that Mirabai suffered so much when she always took Krishna's name? Swami's response was another question where he asked, did Mirabai tell you that she went through troubles? So Swami made it very clear that people, we think that Mirabai suffered. Mirabai as such never suffered. She was lost in the bliss, a bliss that was so supreme that she chose to drink poison rather than give it up. So that is the answer. After which Hislop asks, in the scriptures, there are a number of stories about very great sages who had very big tempers. How could that be? And Swami responds, the angry sages of the scriptures were in error in their sadhana. Their reactions were rajasic. The sattvic sadhanas are best. They give trouble to nobody. Hislop continues, when reading, I found a passage saying that sage Vishwamitra created a duplicate universe. Could such a thing be possible? And Swami responds, yes. The sage agreed to transport one of his disciples to the heavenly regions with the disciple remaining in his physical body. The god did not agree. Vishwamitra became very angry and created a universe, even though God came to him and asked him not to. Vishwamitra created even a pantheon of gods in the subtle space and then transported his disciple there in body. But that which is contrary to God's will cannot last. And Vishwamitra's universe did not endure. So, two questions here. Both are related, because for the first question is about how can sages who are such great in their spiritual sadhana and tapas be men of anger, and Swami responds saying that when there is a rajasic element that comes in their sadhana, that is what makes them susceptible to all these. And next he asks a question as to how is it that sage Vishwamitra created a parallel universe. Swami says, yes, he did that. And again, the root cause there was anger, because he got angry that he's not being allowed to do something that he wants. He went out of the way to do something. And Swami said, because it is not in sync with God's will, it didn't last long. Anything that is not in sync with God's will does not last long.
Right. The episode from the Puranas, I think we had even discussed about this during our Bhagavat Vahini or Ramkatha Raswahini, I'm not sure where. The Trishanku Loka, which
Trishanku Swarga.
Swarga, which he creates, is actually supposed to be a very, very righteous king, who's one of the ancestors of Lord Rama. I think that's why it comes in Ramkatha Raswahini, where Satyavrata or something is his actual name. He's a king who earns a lot of merit, and he actually was supposed to go to heaven from the merit that he had earned being a very righteous king. He renounces everything. He takes to the life of a sannyasi. So he had that the blessing of being in heaven, but he had this weird desire of entering heaven with his physical body. And that's how first he goes to Vasishtha. Vasishtha refuses. And then he goes to Vasishtha's son. And Vasishtha's son is very upset with him that he's trying to turn him against his own father. He's asking for a request that his father has turned him down. And that's how he curses him. And he undergoes some physical deformity, because of which he gets the name Trishanku. And then he goes to Vishwamitra. And Vishwamitra, he had that earlier grudge with Vasishtha. And that is how he creates this entire thing. And in the journey of Vishwamitra also, we have studied that, you know, how he overcomes all of his rajasic tendencies. Swami would give that example of the difference between Vasishtha and Vishwamitra. Vishwamitra was actually a king, King Kaushika, who wanted to become a rishi. And the things which were stopping him were all the outcomes of that rajasic nature which comes with a kshatriya birth, where he has a lot of lust, which is overcome because of one episode. He has a lot of anger, which is again overcome through a couple of episodes. And then when he realizes that these are the mistakes, you know, and then he gets over them, then he gets the title of the Brahma Rishi Vishwamitra. And it's a very beautiful thing. Sometimes I think there are some people who have made this explanation about angry saints or angry sages, where if you're an angry sadhaka who becomes a sage, you become an angry sage. I think this is a statement, it is made in some places. We might have also quoted it. But Swami says it is not so. Yours should become the nature of that sattva. I think again that topic which was discussed a couple of episodes back in the conversations itself, where Swami was saying that nature is sattva. That is there in each one of you, each one of us. And we only have to uncover that. And that's the whole process of sadhana. So Swami is saying that, yes, if there is anger, if there is temper, it is a flaw. And that has to be overcome. And it is not that you cannot achieve anything without overcoming that. Best example is Vishwamitra and sages like Durvasa, who had a lot of spiritual accomplishment, but that part of their character was yet to be transformed. So Swami is saying that is a flaw.
Interestingly, I remember hearing a discourse where Swami said that Durvasa, I don't know about Vishwamitra, but Durvasa at least, Swami says that he was a sage who showed anger in order to achieve the Lord's mission.
Right.
You know, Swami almost likens his anger to Swami's anger. We have seen Swami look angry, we have seen Swami appear angry. Yet at the same time, we have seen innumerable instances to show that it cannot be the anger as we know it. Because, you know, Prem, we have seen Swami be furious at a person, and the next second, literally the next second, Swami turns around and speaks to the other person with so much of joy and calm. I mean, it is worldly wise impossible, you know, the kind of anger that we get in when I'm angry at X or Y. I am angry at all the alphabets from A to Z. At least till that anger subsides. So that is the kind of anger, possibly that is sattvic anger. It doesn't mean if a person is sattvic, he will never appear angry, he will never appear excited. But all of that will be emotions that are being used like costumes in a drama, just to achieve a purpose, achieve an effect, not because the individual is actually affected. And you know, when Swami says that Vishwamitra created a pantheon of gods in the subtle space, I just couldn't help smiling to myself, thinking that creating gods in the subtle space has become an industry now. Everywhere we see this mushrooming, and in the name of subtle body or subtle divinity, people are, you know, making money, and well, the less said about it, the better. But again, why I brought it up is because Swami says, anything that is contrary to God's will cannot last. So it might look like people doing evil or people doing bad are succeeding, but it's just about the time. I think, was it you? You only had said once that in the end it will all be set right. If it is not set right, then it is not yet the end. You know, in Hindi they will say it as picture abhi bhi baki hai. The movie is still left. It is only the interval possibly. So that is the thing we have to hold on, irrespective of how many people are treading the wrong path or how successful they appear to have become. None of those are justifications for us to abandon the right path and go on to the wrong path. In fact, you know, when Swami says that things that are contrary to God's will cannot last, I think the automatic corollary to that is things that are willed by God will last. And the other day, I happened to see a very interesting video on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Somebody, in a matter of 12 minutes, visually, through the map of India, Bharat, has summarized for the last 5,000 years, who all have ruled this land, you know, Bharat. I will not say India because it includes parts of present-day Pakistan, Afghanistan, Nepal, Tibet, all these areas. So, when you see that, you come across a period of around 800 years when almost the entire Bharatvarsha, the entire country of India with all surrounding countries is ruled by rulers who are inimical to the Sanatana Dharma, who possibly hate the Sanatana Dharma, who want to put it down. And it has generally been studied that in civilizations across the world, for 200 years, if one way of life is led, it usually replaces completely the way of life and the civilization that existed before that. But in Bharat, if you see, for 800 years, it was ruled by, as I said, forces inimical to the Sanatana Dharma. Yet 800 years later, Sanatana Dharma had not got destroyed, and even to this day, Sanatana Dharma is vibrant. And when I saw this, the thought that came to my mind was this, what Swami is saying here. Because I felt that unless it is God's will that this Dharma has to survive, it is just not possible. It is just not possible. So that is the power of God's will. What has been willed has to happen. If it has not been willed, though it may be appearing to be a runaway success, it's only short-lived. It is bound to collapse because it is not God's will.
And after this, Hisla passed a question which is going to make a reference to something that was discussed earlier. But maybe before that, dear listeners, we'll just take a quick little break. And don't go away. We'll continue with this conversation. And hopefully, we will not have any disruptions thereafter and we'll be able to conclude this episode.
Thank you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We will continue with the conversation. Hislop now asks Swami, Prahlada was not fully God realized since his body continued to live. I think this is a reference to what Swami said about Jeevan Mukta.
Right.
Saying that within 21 days maximum, the Jeevan Mukta gives up his body. So he says, Prahlada was not God realized since his body continued to live. How could he, therefore, be so firmly established in the Atma that he could endure extreme torture with a smile? And Swami says, Prahlada was a special case created by God as an example of perfect faith in the name of God, an absolute unchanging faith that God was in all things, even inanimate pillars and idols. Prahlada felt no pain during his torture because of his perfect faith that God would come when called. God blocked out all the pain. So, it's like, though a person, a devotee, may not be fully God-realized, even becoming a perfect instrument, he or she will enjoy the same status as a God-realized one.
Right, and Swami is very clearly saying that he was set up as an example, that what happens when you listen, in fact, when you go into the story of Prahlada and Hiranyakashipu, that's what happens. He literally goes as, you know, many times we have discussed about this, when you talk about why do devotees have to suffer, and you have a lot of devotees, you have to go through a lot of hardships. Prahlada is the typical example. Hiranyakashipu was known for torturing and troubling a lot of people, troubling the citizens in his own country. It was almost like, you know, the Lord sends one devotee into the family and now you say, now you touch my devotee and then I'll come and catch you. Right? And it was literally like that. It was, Prahlada was sent as a devotee to the family. His faith was unshakable. Because many times when you look at children having that kind of an affiliation towards Swami, or they take to bhajan singing or Vedam chanting, you would find that the atmosphere plays a very important role in that, the kind of upbringing. Prahlada had that upbringing, as long as they say when Narada was speaking to his mother when he was still in the womb and all of that. Mm. But nevertheless, very soon he goes into that kingdom where he's taken care of by his father, who's put into the Gurukula, where, you know, all of the things which will make him as cruel as his father are being taught. But he never changes his affection towards the Lord. Literally, in that sense, he was an example. And Swami says that it was an example that was presented, that if you're able to take to the chanting of the name incessantly, if you're able to see beyond that pain, beyond that suffering, and be attached to God, literally you will be numb to all those pain that happens, and you will be able to see God where, you know, in everything. It is almost like a practice that you have to take upon yourself.
You know, while speaking about devotion and bhakti also, our scriptures refer to two kinds of devotion. One is the Marjala Nyaya, one is the Markata Nyaya. Marjala in Sanskrit refers to a cat, and Markata refers to a monkey. So the scriptures say that if you look at the monkey child holds on to the mother monkey tightly, and the mother monkey jumps over buildings, over trees, anywhere, keeps moving without the slightest worry because the child is holding on so tight. That is one kind of a devotee who, through sadhana and effort, holds on tight. On the other hand, there is a kitten, the little baby cat, you know. The kitten has complete trust in the cat, in the mother. And therefore, the mother carries the kitten around everywhere. The cat has very, very sharp teeth. You know, with one bite, it is able to slice the neck of rats. Yet at the same time, with the same teeth, the mother holds the kitten ever so gently, holding the kitten tight enough so that the kitten does not fall off, yet holding it gentle enough so that the kitten is not hurt. The kitten has no idea at all. Wherever it needs to go, it is taken. It has complete trust. In fact, many times the kitten is sleeping when the mother is carrying. So, this refers to a kind of devotee who has totally surrendered everything to the Lord. And it now becomes the Lord's responsibility to be alert. As I said, the mother monkey runs about with gay abandon without even worrying about anything, knowing that the child is anyway holding on. Here the role is reversed. The kitten sleeps with gay abandon. I mean, I don't know if it consciously even knows that my mother is holding me. It has complete trust in the mother. So devotees are also of two kinds, where one devotee through his or her efforts holds on to the Lord. The other devotee has surrendered in such a manner that the Lord holds on to the devotee. And it is very evident that Prahlada was a case of being a Marjala Nyayi rather than a Markata Nyayi.
Right. And when Swami speaks about that state which Prahlada was in, Swami says Prahlada felt no pain during his torture because of his perfect faith that God would come when called and God blocked all the pain. I mean, before that, Swami says Prahlada was a special... where Swami says that he had the ability to see God was in all things, even inanimate pillars and idols, because of that unchanging faith.
Hmm.
And when Swami says that, Isla Pass, one would greatly wish to see God only, seeing that, you know, we also have that desire. Who wouldn't, especially after having seen Swami in a beautiful form?
Hmm.
Who wouldn't want that experience of having being able to see Swami in everything and everyone? So Swami replies to that, it is not that one takes every object in the world and changes it into God. One is not able to do that. It is not possible to take nature and all objects and make them one shade of color, isn't it? But if one puts on glasses of a certain color, then everything is seen in that color. One is able to change one's eyes so that everything they see is that one color, God.
Continuing, Hislop says, Swami says that all should be seen as God. One should also see his wife as God. And Swami responds, wife should not be seen as God. If so seen, she will sit on your head. She should be treated as wife. And God should be seen as her inner reality. You know, both these questions and answers, this is a confusion that arises in all of us, because we wonder, what does Swami mean by seeing God in all? If I am supposed to see God in the cab driver who comes to pick me up, should I tell him? I mean, if I imagine Swami to be at the wheel, what would I do? I would first open the driver's door and take Pad Namaskar and tell, you please sit, I will drive. Okay. Should I do that to the cab driver? What about the person who is working as a maid at home or whatever? I mean, if Swami comes in that manner, I will not allow Swami to do any work. I will make Swami sit on the chair, do Pada Puja, and I will worship him. So practically it looks like if I see everyone as divine, I just cannot do anything else but keep worshipping whomever I meet. But when Swami says that, it is not that. Because the same Swami who says, see divinity in everything, even in inanimate objects, says don't see God in your wife, treat her as your wife. I think this, for me personally, it got resolved with a beautiful analogy of the drama, acting in a drama. And when Swami says, see God in everyone, it is about me as an actor in the drama realizing that all others are actors. As actors, we are all equal. But we are not all equal in the roles we are playing. In the drama, suppose I am playing the role of an emperor and somebody is playing the role of an enemy. I am supposed to pull out the sword and cut his neck. That is the role. That is the role I am playing. But though I cut his neck, in my heart, on my face, there might be anger. I might shout out words telling, I am going to chop your neck. But in my heart, there is not even the slightest trace of anger, because I know he is a fellow actor with whom I'll possibly have coffee and tea after the drama is over. So that awareness that all are one is what is meant by seeing God in all, seeing everyone as equal. I don't, you know, later when I go to the cafeteria to have tea, I will not tell him that, hey, you are an enemy, get out. No, we are one. I don't feel that you are low, I am high. I know. At the same time, though I am aware that all are actors, all are equal, it doesn't affect the role that I have to play. I play my role as an emperor, as a father, as a friend. So also, in real life, I think whether it's a wife, husband, servant, maid, or master, boss, king, all these are different roles. For the success of the drama, we have to play the roles. But at the back of the mind, this truth should be permanent, the foundation, the unseen foundation for this mansion of life should be the awareness of the truth that all are one, all are divine, all are different roles that are being played by actors who are equal.
One beautiful thing of living in Swami's presence is the one thing that Swami would in a very subtle manner teach to all of us is the same Swami, you know, when you're talking about seeing Swami in others and treating them differently, the way you treat your wife should be different from the way you treat other women, even though you see the same Swami in others. But when you look at interacting with Swami, Swami would expect that you interact with Swami differently based on the deshakala paristhiti or the situation which there is in. A lot of these students would say this. In the interview room, Swami is absolutely intimate. You could ask him anything. You could speak harshly with him. You know, if you're angry about something, you could pour out that anger to Swami, and Swami will tolerate everything. But the moment you step out of the interview and there are devotees watching, your relationship with the same Swami, it's not a different Swami, has to become very formal. It'll be completely different. When Swami comes out in a convocation procession, Swami comes out as a chancellor. The way your body language is supposed to be around Swami and on that occasion is very different. So the same Swami, we had this different relationships with him based on where we were. When we were talking to one of the very old devotees, they were narrating this. Apparently Swami used to stay a lot in their house in the initial years, in the 50s and 60s, when Swami used to travel around Rajahmundry and all of these places. So for them, Swami was a part of the family. And when Swami was visiting, Swami would be at their house for about a week or so. I'm not even aware of that family's name, so I'm not quoting any of the names. So Swami would come and, you know, literally Swami was the head of the family, who would sit at the head of the table, and everybody would sit around. They would prepare food for Swami. And when Swami would sit down to eat, Swami would mix all the food, and there were three or four brothers, the elders in the family. They would walk up to Swami, and Swami would put one morsel of rice in each one of their hands before they start eating and sit with Swami and eat. That was how intimate they were. And after a certain point, Swami started telling them, see, more devotees are coming, and you know, all of them also should have the opportunity to move closely with Swami. Swami did not tell them that I want to stop this chance of you sitting and dining with me. But they got it, and after that they stopped sitting on any of the tables where Swami would sit, even if it is their own house or if they are hosting Swami elsewhere, because they felt that now Swami feels that others should get the chance. So whenever Swami would come to the house, there were more devotees there. They would be like very formal with Swami, serving Swami and all of that. So they were saying that at one point, after many, many years, it so happened that Swami was staying in their house and there were no outsiders and there were no other visitors and all that. And Swami sat down and Swami was about to eat. So the eldest brother in that family, he walked up to Swami, and when Swami was about to eat, he caught Swami's hand. And he said, now nobody is there, now you better give us. Like how you used to give before. And Swami was also so happy to do that. So clearly it's the same Swami, it's not two, three Swamis, it's the same Swami to whom we had to interact with differently based on who is in front of Swami or what is the situation around Swami, what is the role Swami is playing for that particular occasion, whether it's a public function or it's a... The way Swami would be treated when he is in the hostel with students was different. When Swami was in Thrayi, it was different. Probably that this is the training that Swami was giving us, that yes, you have to see Swami in everyone, but the way you see Swami in your mother has to be different from the way you see Swami in a neighbor. The way you see Swami in a boss has got to be different with the way you see Swami in a stranger. But at the same time, the underlying feeling is different. As Swami would say, you cannot have Vishaya Advaita. There cannot be, you know,
oneness
in materials or in objects. Something is a shoe and something is a, you know, handkerchief. You can't treat the two as the same. But there should always be Bhava Advaita, in the feeling that underlying all this is the same Swami. And that will, you know, in a certain case, it'll be like you speaking more humbly. In a certain case, it'll be like you becoming more patient. In a certain case, it'll be like you becoming more charitable. The way it expresses will be different, but you cannot have that oneness in the way you treat everyone, in the way you interact with everyone.
Picking a science example, you know, the way I treat charcoal versus the way I treat diamond, basically it is the same. Right. We have studied it. It comes, I think, in 5th grade or 6th grade, that graphite, which goes into our pencil lids, and diamond are both carbon atoms only, nothing but carbon atoms. And interestingly, both are carbon atoms that have been pressurized and subjected to great temperatures. Yet, one is invaluable, one is not so valuable. I mean, it's a common day-to-day stuff. So, though it is the same, like you said, it is not Vishaya Advaita. I cannot say graphite and diamond are the same. They are different. Yet, there is Bhava Advaita, that is in the awareness that they are the same. Yet the way I treat graphite, the way I treat diamond will be different because, as you said, there's no oneness in the object, but there is oneness in their basic constitution. A visitor now asks Swami, these miracles that Swami does by moving his hand and out come very costly things from nowhere, is there some explanation? Swami so lovingly explains, some objects Swami creates in just the same way that he has created the material universe. Other objects such as watches are brought from existing supplies. There are no invisible beings helping Swami to bring things. His sankalpa, his divine will, brings the object in a moment. Swami is everywhere. His creations belong to the natural unlimited power of God and are in no sense the product of yogic powers as with yogis or the magic as with magicians. The creative power is in no way contrived or developed. It is natural. And that is why Swami would say, what appears as ascharyam for you, surprising for you, is sahajam for me, natural to me.
Many times, you know, when Swami would materialize some objects in Kodaikanal, especially objects of historical significance, Swami would say, Tundarga Chudandi, see it fast. I have to send it back before the people in the museum notice that it is missing. So literally Swami would say that it has been brought from, Swami is saying, yes, some things are created from existing supplies. Because Swami sometimes would give watches and things like that,
which are branded.
Right. But some other things which Swami would give are, you probably will not find anywhere. I recall a very beautiful incident which happened to one of our seniors in Trai Vrindavan. His mother was suffering from a very rare and very painful skin disease. The doctors could not do anything. She was undergoing treatment for many, many years. And one day in Trai, Swami was speaking about his mother, and Swami asked, how is she, and what are the doctors saying, everything. And then as Swami was getting up and leaving, suddenly Swami stopped, turned to this boy, and Swami said, I will give medicine. There is no medicine in the world for this, but in Sai store there is medicine for everything. So some things are, you know, do not belong to this world, do not belong to any existing supply that we know of. But Swami says that, how do you make out that is this materialized now? Is this being made now? There are many, many such beautiful experiences. One of the students of the MBA class, this was being narrated by a friend of his, apparently Swami had given him a chain. And Swami said, be very careful with this, and this will protect you, or something like that. He had gone for boating somewhere in Hyderabad or something, I think Hussain Sagar or somewhere, where while boating something, he fell into the water or something, and when he got back, the chain wasn't there. And when he came back after vacations, Swami materialized the same chain for him with, you know, the mud stuck in between the links. Swami said, I got it from the bottom of the lake.
Wow.
So, materializations, you can only be awestruck by them. You can never understand them completely.
There was also the story of this Norwegian devotee. I forget his name, Tide Man or something like that. I'm not recollecting. I read it in Howard Murfitt's book, where he loses a ring that Swami has given him in the Ganges. And then when he comes to Prashanthi Nilayam, Swami gives it back to him. The same ring, which he says should have been lost forever because the Ganges is deep, 40 feet below in a flowing river, don't know where, but Swami retrieves and gives. So there is no limiting the power of Swami, and a person who can, you know, dive to the depths of the river Ganga, which is the longest river in India, and fetch a ring, surely can also manifest and create a new ring. Like we discussed during our various satsangs and even in the Satya to Sai, I think all these things Swami does simply to bring in variety in the Leelas so that we can discuss about it, enjoy it. So that is the explanation he gives.
Even when Swami was explaining about the cross that he materialized, Swami had said that. That the wood was so old it had disintegrated, but I
gather atoms.
Right, gather atoms and remake.
Reconstitute.
The cross, right.
I think we have time for just one more question possibly. And Hislop asks, is it true that wild animals will not harm a saintly person? And Swami says, there was once a guru who told his disciple that God was in everything. The disciple believed the statement. That very day, there was a royal parade. The king was the center of attraction, riding on an enormous elephant. Ignoring the rules of safety for such parades, the disciple planted himself firmly in the path of the royal elephant. And he paid no attention to the cries and warning that he could be trampled to death. Upon reaching him, the elephant lifted him, put him safely to one side. The disciple then went to the guru and complained that although God was in both the elephant and himself, he had been unable to remove the elephant from his path. That on the contrary, the elephant had removed him. The guru explained that it was merely a matter of the elephant having greater physical strength. He told the disciple that had he not been looking at God in the elephant, the beast would have killed him just as a matter of ordinary work. However, since the disciple was looking at God in the elephant, God had safely lifted him out of harm's way. No animal, not even a cobra, will harm the person who sees God as the essential reality of the animal or the snake. The same is usually true as regards dangerous men, but there are some exceptions here because of karmic implications. So it's such a beautiful thing. Swami says that if you develop that divine vision, if you are able to have that attitude, you are firmly rooted in the truth that everything is divine, then Swami says, yes, wild animals, snakes, dangerous animals will also not harm you. Even people will not, except in a few cases where there is a karmic backlog.
Right. And once you read this, and there's a other story very similar to this, which Swami says about the mahout shouting, get away. And you
interestingly, know, that is actually an original parable by Ramakrishna Paramahamsa.
Right.
Where he says that there is a guru who tells his disciple that God is in everything. And Ramakrishna says that this disciple goes in the path of a mad elephant, rogue elephant, which the mahout is trying to control. The elephant swats this man who goes, falls to the side and gets injured, and the elephant goes on its way. And everyone comes and asks, sir, were you mad? Why didn't you move away? He goes to his guru and he asks, what went wrong? You said God is in everything. Why didn't God in the elephant respond? Ramakrishna Paramahamsa says that the guru tells this disciple that you did not respond to the God in the mahout. There is God in the mahout as well. He is telling, get out of the way, get out of the way. Why you didn't listen? That is why this happened. Very interesting here that Swami narrates a story which is very similar yet a different ending. It shows that had you not been genuine in your feeling that there is divinity there, you might have got killed. Here you just got injured, and in the other case you were just brushed to the side. So possibly in the exceptions, this is what we have to consider. That when you say divinity is there in all, just don't focus on divinity in only one. Focus on divinity in all.
Right. Two or three things which comes out from this statement is, as you said, if the feeling is genuine, if you are truly trying to see God in that person, you believe that. Swami says that, you know, even what was supposed to be a very harming situation will turn out to be much milder than what it would have been. And that's one example that Swami gives. And the other thing which Swami says is, how often we forget to look at common sense as a gift from God, right? Mm-hmm. We always look at, as we were saying, we want a divine vision, we want some ability to look into the future, we want ability to look at people's past and all of that. But we don't realize that simple discrimination that God has given. Swami would say that buddhi is closest to the atma. That is something which we forget. And Swami would say that common sense is so important. And since it is so common, we think it is nothing special about it. And that's one thing which comes across in this. When I was reading this, there's the last statement which Swami makes, which says the same is usually true as regards dangerous men. But there are some exceptions here because of karmic implications. In fact, one of the very few stories of a sage being attacked by wild animals and dying is there's a story of sage Parashara, who's supposed to be, I'm not sure of, I think he is also the father of Ravana. He is supposed to be one of the great sages in the Indian tradition. So he dies when...
I think Pulastya is the father of Ravana.
Pulastya is the father of Ravana, right. Parashara is one of the saints who comes in the Vedic tradition. A very, very famous saint. So he dies by an attack of wild wolves when he's walking with his disciples. And the way he dies also is very, very beautifully captured. He says that, you know, the wolves start attacking him. He tells all his disciples to go. And at that moment, he says that, okay, this is my moment. The time has come. And he says, it is time for this body to become one with that body of the wolf. And he does not see that as being attacked by wild animals or as an accident. He says this is the moment this body has to be discarded. And this being has to become one with that being. That is the will of God. And Swami is saying that sometimes if it is part of destiny, then it might happen. But there is again, when you look at the example, it is not one of suffering. It is not one of fear. It is not one of dejection. It is one of complete acceptance, which also becomes like an example for the rest of us.
Moreover, Parashara may not qualify as a dangerous man. When Swami says the same is usually true as regards dangerous men, it is almost like even in dangerous men, if you are able to see God, you will be protected, nothing will happen because you are able to see God in that. However, in some exceptional cases, if that dangerous man has been so created to complete some karma of yours, then alone, means that is God's will, that's why it will happen. But otherwise, as a general rule, you know, because what one thing that becomes very clear here is if you are having that divine vision, the ability to see divinity in all, the general rule is divinity will shower itself through everyone on you as well. Only in a few exceptional cases. And I don't think we should focus too much on the exceptions because the term itself says it's an exception. So what we can take home is the general rule that the divinity that we see outside is the divinity that will reflect on us as well. If we have the glasses of divine love when we look at everyone and everything also will shower on us the same affection and love of divinity. I think on that note, dear listeners, our time comes to a close. We shall conclude here and take up this discussion again next week. Very, very interesting it has been, and as always, it has been very revealing and enlightening for us, and we hope it has been the same to you as well. So we will meet again next week at the same time with the next episode of Afternoon Satsang on Conversations with Satya Sai. Till then, enjoy this song, on the other side of which there is the segment by Brother Chandu, Love to Love. So till then, once again wishing you all a very happy and holy, wonderful 2020. May our love for Swami keep growing every day of this new year. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.
నీ దరికి చెరాలని విరిచేత నది.